From Migration Media, this is Migratory Patterns. I'm your host, Mike Shaw. This week's guest has seen it all. 99-year-old Eleanor Liu might very well be the oldest expat in China. Born in Tennessee in the days after World War I, she came of age in the American South during the Great Depression and World War II. In the years that followed, she would graduate from university, get her master's degree, and meet the love of her life, John Liu, a decommissioned Chinese soldier who had been stationed in the UK during the war. Their mixed marriage, raising of their family, and opening one of the first Chinese restaurants in Nashville would be amazing enough, but that's just where their story begins. Eleanor and John eventually found themselves in Taiwan, and then mainland China within a few years after Deng Xiaoping's opening of the country in 1979. They built a home in what was then the outskirts of the city, and spent the next 20 years splitting their time between Beijing and the U.S. Now they're in Beijing full-time, where four generations share the courtyard house they've built so many years ago. Through it all, Eleanor's love of teaching has driven her and helped her make a meaningful impact no matter where she's lived. She taught English to the first crop of Chinese students who were chosen to travel overseas for university after Deng's opening, and she taught Tai Chi at a YWCA back in the U.S. In this interview, she teaches me that home is where you make your mark and where your loved ones are. I've been waiting a while to share this interview with you, and I'm really, really excited that I finally get to. I do want to make a note and apologize. The audio on this is not the greatest. There was a malfunction with the microphone during the recording session. And by malfunction, I mean that the person running it, your lovable host, hit the wrong button, and unfortunately the input was going in through the laptop microphone instead of the professional microphone. This is the same rookie mistake I made for the very first interview that I did, and I made it again. I was so excited to sit down with Eleanor, I totally lost track of what I was doing, I didn't pay attention to the right buttons, and I just was a blithering fanboy, and I want to apologize to you and apologize to Eleanor and her family. You will hear a little bit of background noise. It's cleaned up pretty well. You'll hear a little background noise. There'll be a point where Eleanor's husband comes into the room. You might hear some noise, and her daughter-in-law, Cosima, you may hear her voice as well. But actually, the quality came out okay. It's totally understandable. I'm really, really happy that I got to sit down with her, and I hope you enjoy my talk with Eleanor Liu. Eleanor Liu, welcome to Migratory Patterns.
Thank you.
Where is home?
Right now, home is in Beijing, but we have also a home in Topeka, Kansas with our daughter, but we haven't been there for several years.
Several years. I think I read when I was reading about you a little bit online that you used to go back every year. Did you split your time?
That's right. We used to spend the summers in China, but we would spend the winters with our daughter in Kansas because the house here, the corridors are not heated. So we go from hot to cold. And that way we would, in her house, we were in an even heat.
I was going to say that's kind of the opposite from what the government officials do. They all leave town in the summer and they're here in the winter. The opposite. Now, you have been in Beijing. What year did you move back here?
I think we came back in 1982, but then we were here just about a month and we went back and we both had some health problems. 82, John had a heart attack. 83, I had a ruptured appendix. So it was really after 84 that we started living here a lot.
So let's back up. What is your husband's name?
His name is Liu Guoan in the Chinese.
Liu Guoan.
Liu Guoan. But when he came to America, for some reason, he put his name down as John Sheng Kuang Liu. He often signed it John S.K. Liu. And he got the name John in England when some girls met him in he was in the army, I think. And they asked him what his mother called him. And he said, she called me Chungi. And they said, it sounds like Johnny. So they named him John. That's where he got the John. And so he went by that. And Of course, by staying in Europe several years, he was more westernized than a lot of the Chinese would have been.
So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee.
Nashville, Tennessee.
And I, as I said, I went to the Hume Fogg High School there, but then we went to Jackson, Tennessee, and I graduated there. And then my father was a bookbinder, and he had several different offers, and he would take a better job. We lived in Mississippi for a while, and then we went to Virginia, and it was in Roanoke, Virginia, where I took my business course.
This was after high school.
After high school. And my sister had married and was living in Montgomery, Alabama. So she asked me to come to Montgomery and get a job there so we would be together. We were always very close. So I went to Montgomery, and that's when I started working for Mr. Galloway, a real estate man. And I worked for him for 10 or 12 years.
This would have been end of the Depression and through the war?
This was, the war was over. Let's see, where was I when the, we were in Montgomery, and there were two airfields there, Gunter Field and Maxwell Field. And so I was there during the war because I went in 42, and the war wasn't over till 45. So that was during that time.
And I believe you ended up in Topeka, right? Was that when you went to university?
No, I went to college 10 years later in Nashville, Tennessee.
Oh, Nashville.
Where I had grown up. And then I graduated from David Lipscomb College, which is now David Lipscomb University. And I graduated in 1951. And then John, we left, we left Nashville and went to Indianapolis, Indiana.
And John came over to university?
He wanted to go to, he really wanted to be an engineer. So he went to Purdue Extension in Indianapolis for 2 years. And then he had to go to West Lafayette, to the main campus, for the last 2 years. So I had started teaching, and I was teaching in Indianapolis. And we had bought a house there. But then he finished Purdue in 19...
Was it the same time that you finished, or after you finished your
university? Yeah, I finished in 59, he finished. And he was only offered low-paying jobs. And right. He said, why should I start at the bottom when I can be the boss? And there was no Chinese restaurant in Bloomington at that time.
Were there Chinese people?
No, there were some Chinese people, of course, at Indiana University, which is in Bloomington, the main campus. And so I was teaching in Indianapolis, but he went to Bloomington. So we sort of traded weekends for a while. And then I was also got a scholarship to Indiana University in Bloomington. So it worked out really well that I could be there. And we had a good babysitter. Of course, the children were just in first and second grade.
And you had two children by then?
I had two children. And so this babysitter went with us to Bloomington, and I went to IU, to graduate school, and I graduated with, I got my master's in 61, which was 10 years after the other.
What is the master's in?
The master's in Russian language and literature.
Wow, I'm sure that serves you really well in China.
I had been teaching, and there was a radio program that was teaching some basic Russian.
Sure. Well, you need to learn.
And so I had listened to that with my classroom, and we had learned some Russian songs. And then I saw in the newspaper where the NDEA was looking for future Russian teachers, and they had 30 places, and it was going to be in IU. And I told John, I said, I kind of like to apply for that. He said, oh, you're just afraid you wouldn't get it. And I said, I'll show you. So I applied, and just 3 or 4 days afterwards, I got a telephone call. You're in.
That's fantastic.
But the funny thing was that we graduated, there were 30 of us, and we graduated in 61 with a master's degree in Russian language and literature. Only 2 out of the 30 got jobs teaching Russian, because after the 2 years before, it had been very popular, and everybody thought that high schools would be teaching it. But of those 30 people, only 2. So I had applied in Bloomington, since John was there, to teach at the Bloomington High School, teach Russian. And I had many Russian friends there and was quite fluent in it for a while. I've gotten most of it now because I don't use it. But the school, the superintendent took my application and everything, and he said, well, we're thinking about it. But then he called me and he said, we're not going to give Russian. So I had been teaching in Indianapolis before. I didn't have a job, but I wrote back to Indianapolis. They sent me a contract and wanted me to come. And so I was just about to go there, and the superintendent called me and he said, I have a 6th grade opening at Rogers School. I want you to go out and check it. So, of course, if I had been teaching in Indianapolis, I would have 100 miles every day back and forth. So I went out to see the principal, and he wanted me to teach there. So that's how I got started in Bloomington to teach. And I had many Russian friends. So at that first year that I started, we decided to have a special activities group. So since I had all these Russian friends, I decided we would teach Russian and teach little folk dances and things. So the children, the girls wore, we had their parents make them little journals and dresses and skirts. And the boys took a white shirt and they cut the collar off and had braid around there and a braid down here. So we had the costumes, and my Russian teachers came out and taught them songs and little stories in Russian. And we put on programs for the school, and it turned out really nice for a while, but we didn't keep it up.
The demise of the Russian language in schools aside, you've been teaching for a long time. You started teaching back then, and you were teaching, I think I saw a video of you teaching Tai Chi, a handful of years ago.
Yeah, I taught Tai Chi at the YWCA in Topeka.
When was that you started that?
Let's see, after we moved to, we built under Diana's house, and we moved from Bloomington to Topeka, or it's right out of Topeka, it's in Tecumseh on the lake, and we moved there in 87 or 88, something like that.
So it's about the time you were coming to China regularly, and you were going,
because
you were going back.
I was teaching in Bloomington, and 1979, John, my husband, and my son, John, Dennis, came to China because his mother got sick, and they thought she was really very, very sick. But they came, and I couldn't leave school right away, and they came, and he got home just before school was out, and he said, you have to retire. I've got you a job in China. So in 1980 and 81, I taught English in Changsha to some of the first Chinese chosen to go abroad.
Wow.
And that was a very successful time. And they had many Chinese that were training to go abroad.
This is after Deng and the Great Opening.
And they were going, they were not beginning English. They all had good English, but most of them could not understand it when they heard it, and they couldn't speak it. They could read it and translate it, but they couldn't speak or they couldn't understand. So my main purpose was teaching them listening and speaking skills. And I think I had a very successful time with them because I think I had the best kind of schedule for them. When I was leaving Bloomington, I went to the superintendent and asked him if he would give me some books that he had. I said, I know the school has all kinds of sample books, and I need a high-interest, low-level vocabulary books. So I found out at the post office, you can send a post office mail bag, to a foreign country for $50, and you can put 50 or more books, so you can fill it up with books. No advertising, no magazines or advertising, but you can have books. So he gave me just some wonderful books, some other people donated books, and I had 7 book bags, post office bags, that I brought to China. So when they came, I told the president of the university, I said, I have these books, and oh, good, we can put them in the library. And I said, who uses the library? He said, the teachers. I said, these are not for the teachers. These are for my students. And I said, if you'll put shelves in my, they've given me a nice office. And I said, if you'll put shelves in my office, then I can teach them to alphabetize by the authors. I can teach them to make cards, check them in and out. Then they can then read them. So every day I took some of the books that I wanted to use, and I had a little blackboard about the size of that TV thing and a piece of chalk and an eraser. That was the equipment they gave me. And I had my little tape recorder. So every day I picked out a passage that I wanted to read, usually about science or nature or some interesting thing, but the vocabulary was very simple. And I made 10 questions, and I wrote the questions on the board. And I read the passage one time into my recorder, and I played it 2 more times. And every single day, those 52 people that I had in 2 classes answered those 10 questions. So I graded them every night. And I think that's what was so successful, because when maybe the other classes that they had in Beijing, Shanghai, Changzhou only read and talked, and then when they took the exam, they had to listen for. And so I think years later, 20 years afterwards, one of my students that would live here in Beijing came out, and he said, you didn't know it, but they sent 3 people to see why our class did so well.
You brought the new teaching style to the system. I would like to back up just a little bit and ask you, when you met your husband and when you were living together, was there ever a thought or an idea? Did you imagine one day that you would end up moving to China?
No, at that time we didn't have any idea that we could come to China, because actually he was a person without a country then, because in 1949, see, we didn't marry till 1950. In 1949, the government changed, and he had been in the army. Of course, the army had, by the time I think he mustered out of the army as when he came to America just before that. He had been given the job of, when the war was over, he'd been given the job of repatriating all the Chinese who had caught in Europe during the war and couldn't leave. And then it was in 1947, he decided he wanted to come back to China. But when he applied for a visa from Russia to ride the Trans-Siberian back, they wouldn't give him a visa for some reason. So he goes to the United States, and one of his friends said, you can go to the U.S. So he landed in New York City on the Queen Mary on July the 7th, 1947, which was exactly 10 years after the Marco Polo Bridge. So by that time, he'd been in Europe all that time and was quite westernized. He wore Western clothes and spoke good English. And so it wasn't so different. And we found that we just had a lot in common, even though we were about the same age. And so it just worked out well.
Yeah. And it was natural for him to be able to settle in the U.S. with you.
Yeah, and in fact, he had one of the earliest green cards that were ever issued because he, for a while, and when he first came to China to visit his mother in 73, he was traveling on a U.S. travel document because he had no country then.
And did you say that when you decided to come over here to China to start moving or at least splitting your time, was that because his mother got sick? Is that what happened?
Well, because they came over in 79 and his mother was sick. But after 3 days, she got up and was feeling fine. And she lived to be, she lived two more years. She died in 81 and I was teaching in Changsha. And they called the school and said that she had died. And John happened to be back in the States. He had to take care of business. We still had the business then. He was in the States and the president said, we'll let you go. And I said, no, it'll just be more problem if I go because people just swarmed in to see the foreigner. And I said, I'll wait till John gets back and we'll go and visit her grave. So that's what we did. But he wasn't here when, and he had told his brother and given his brother money for the funeral, and because he knew his mother was very frail, and he said, "Don't wait for me to get back." He said, "You go on and help the funeral." Said, "It'll if she dies before I get back." So that's where. And so when he got back, we went back to see her grave.
So moving to China at that time, this was very early days of the opening. And can you describe what it was like to be a foreigner, not coming for a trip or just for school or, mm-hmm. you know, on some kind of mission for a company yeah. or the government? I mean, you were coming as part of kind of your family journey.
Right.
What did you feel welcome? Did you feel like was the community welcome opening open to you coming?
Yes, most people were very curious about me, and I had very pleasant memories. I don't remember any bad things, but it was a very different place then.
I know we're in your lovely home here. It's your daughter-in-law had said that you had built this in the early 80s.
We started it, and we were supposed to move in 89, and then it got interrupted because of the incident. And so we moved in 1990.
Right. It's a beautiful
Thanksgiving.
It's a beautiful home. You've done a wonderful
My husband drew it out. He planned it all, and we've still got the drawing that he made, and then we got an architect to make the blueprints. So it's all his, and when the same company that built the Great Hall of the People was the ones that constructed the house. But when they got to the inside, they started hiring people that didn't know what they were doing. And John said, no, stop. And so he bought the machines, and we have a woodworking shop, and he hired four carpenters and had them to make all the cabinets and the window frames and the light fixtures, everything according to his plan. So this is a lot of his handiwork.
It's beautiful. And the area you're in, people who aren't familiar with Beijing mm-hmm. won't know, you are out mm-hmm. between the 4th and 5th Ring Roads,
right.
which in those days was just...
We were in the wilderness.
You had wild country out
Nothing
there.
Nothing was out here, and you could see us for miles. Now people don't even know we're here.
You're behind this school. I remember we took the car to get here, and we got dropped off, and, you know, your daughter-in-law said, oh, just keep going down this little street. Yeah. You'll see a gate. And we're like, that little gate?
Yeah. Well, that's what most of the people don't. You say, oh, you can't go in there. And I said, well, I can't because that's where I live. But it is.
You've watched the city grow right
away.
Oh,
yeah. We've watched the city grow. And it was so different when I came in 78. There were very few cars. And people were very curious. You had to be with the travel agent. Even though John was Chinese, we couldn't travel alone. We had to have, so we had this car, and everywhere we went, people would flock out to see the car. And then when they saw me, it was even twice as many.
But at that time, imagine keeping in a car.
At that time, you saw no skin. People wore clothes to the wrists and to the ankles and all dark colors. And even in the circus, they had long costumes, no skin showing. And you didn't see young people hugging or kissing or anything. Once in a while, you'd see them holding hands, but it was quite a different place.
Now, you have, do I count correctly, are there four generations living in this house right now?
That's right. And little Mela is one of the, she's our great-granddaughter.
So you, as a foreigner living in China, you don't just live here. You've raised your family, and they've raised their families here under this roof. What is, do you feel, I mean, obviously, there's always going to be this sense that you're American. You grew up in America. You have this wonderful American story. What about your children and your grandchildren? Do they have a sense of being American?
No, not so much, but they were very fortunate, I think, because they grew up speaking three languages, and they never got mixed up with them. Cosima spoke German with them, John spoke English, and the Ai spoke Chinese. So they learned from the very start, and it's been a boon to them all. It's languages are really a great help to them.
How do you, you used to go back and forth, and you said you haven't gone back in several years now.
Yeah, since 2015, we came over, and then he had a...
But then you went one more time.
You went back. I went back summer before last to my sister's 100th birthday.
Wow. Wow. My grandmother, I believe, she had her 90th birthday a couple of years ago, so she's a spring chicken. And
she had her 90th.
90th, yes. Uh-huh. And I wasn't able to be there, so my wife and I, we recorded a greeting in front of the bell tower.
Oh.
And I said, you know, this neighborhood is 800 years old, almost as old as you. But that, you know, you live in this ancient city, and you've got your whole family here. This is it's a very unusual story for people who grow up in one place.
It is. It's a different...
Yeah, a lot of people who, well, most people in the world who grow up, they grow up in their place and they have their identity that is tied to their place. So when they move, their identity is in flux. I know for myself, I've only been living overseas for 10 years, but already my identity is all sorts of messed up, we could say.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I have a very strong feeling of being a Bostonian, a New Englander, an American, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, I also have this awareness of the rest of the world, and I am a part of it. And I feel like I could go anywhere.
Well, I always say that I was not born for a corner. The whole world is my native land.
That's really good. I'm gonna use that.
Yeah, use that. It's a good quote.
Yeah. So your children and your grandchildren, and now your great-granddaughter, this idea of having the whole world as your corner, is this something that is kind of, do you live this idea? Not just by living here, but do you find your family open to opportunities and other things that are in other places?
Well, I would think so. I think that's been true of especially Kojima's oldest son, Forrest. He's quite an entrepreneur. He's the head of the Ari Camera in here.
Wow. Now, you did I hear correctly, did I read correctly that you had a Chinese restaurant, right?
We had a Chinese restaurant called the Dragon Inn.
The Dragon Inn.
And it's very interesting because I've been very active here in Beijing, in the Beijing International Society. And we have lots of diplomatic people that are in the committee that we plan the activities. And a new one came in just last year, and she said, she found out I had been in Bloomington. We talked about different things. She said, oh, my husband went to IU in Bloomington. And I said, oh, when was he there? And she said, in the 80s. And I said, did he know the Dragon Inn? And he did. And he's the ambassador for the United Arab Emirates. and he went to IU. So it's a small world after all.
It is. You know, one of the things that I talk about a lot when I sit down with, you know, foreigners who want to talk about mm-hmm. what's going on, we have this conversation and it's always such a small community in Beijing. And yeah. I'm just kind of starting my journey of talking to people. Oh. And I'm interested to talk to people who live in other cities. And I wonder if it's the same way, where the communities of international migrants, they tend to be small communities who all know each other within the big cities they live in.
And some people never integrate into it. They yeah. don't have very many Chinese friends, or, you know, they just have their servants, their IEs and so forth.
I feel like those are the people who are just here for a few years.
Yeah, some of them, they don't want to put roots down.
No, they can't for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. But I feel like the community of people who are here for a substantial amount of time, mm-hmm. and I don't want to put a number on it, but there are people who move to a place and don't feel like I'm just going there for this many years. Mm-hmm. They just have this, I'm going to live my life and however long I'm there. Those are the people that really, I feel like, integrate with the community. And that group is always, it feels like it's always very small. And I'm just wondering, when you got here, was there a community of those people yet? I mean, I've only heard of a handful of people that I know of in Beijing who have been here anywhere near as long as you have.
Well, there's not so many.
Did you have a community when you got here that was other foreigners, or were you?
Well,
only
of course, we were a very close knit family, and we had the family, and we did live in the diplomatic compound at Zhengwomen Y. So we did have quite a few foreign friends, but I got into Tai Chi, going to the park every morning, you know, early, and then I started teaching at the Wufang Dashui because John and General Zhang Jun were from the same area. And, oh, by the way, John's little town is Changshou, which means long life, which is very interesting. And in fact, General Zhang Jun just died two or three years ago. I'm not sure whether it's two or three, but he was 101 when he died, and he's from that area.
And you said so is this when you started picking up Tai Chi, was when you moved here?
After we were in the Zhengwomen Y, and I first started with a group of Chinese who were teaching, and he was a master, a very good teacher, and was going to Rutan Park. So after a week, they said, well, you have to pay. And I said, all right, how much do I pay? And so they said, you have to pay $30, 30 yuan a month. So I paid 30 yuan. In 2 weeks or 3 weeks later, when it was time to pay again, it was double for me. The others were paying 10 yuan, the Chinese.
And
so then I went on and paid the 60 for a while. And then they won 120. And I said, that's it. I'm not paying anymore. And I said, I'll just go practice. So I walk all around the park and I see this little group in just off the road a little bit. And they're doing Tai Chi. So I just sort of drop in with them and I start doing it. And they welcomed me and I didn't pay them anything.
That's great. And you picked that up pretty good. I mean, you teach it. Yeah. You were teaching mm-hmm. it up until just a few years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
You said you were also doing that back in the U.S. at the YWCA?
I taught at the YWCA in Topeka.
Wow.
And my daughter's family doctor, who now has retired, he and his wife go to the Y, and they play water volleyball. And so I would go and teach my Tai Chi, and then I'd go get in the pool, and it happened to be the day that they were having water volleyball. So I started playing water volleyball.
So one of the most important things about feeling at home for me, I think, is having a sense of community. And I'm wondering, I'm just curious if you could describe how you feel a part of the community here, what your sense of community is like.
Well, I have a lot of, I go to the Tongmenmen Church every Sunday, and I have a lot of friends there. And I have helped their interpreters, two services every Sunday they have interpreters. And they have little earphones, and we used to have to plug it into a long strip, but now you have individual little ones that they just improve that a lot. So I have a lot of friends there. And then, of course, my, I guess with the Beijing International Society, there's so many friends there, we have a lot.
The expat community, the foreign community, there's a lot of people cycling in and out a lot. It's a very different kind of community than you would have if you lived in the place you are from.
Well, see, for years now, I've been doing what we call ourselves Tuesday Trotters. You might have noticed in the book about the Tuesday Trotters. And we go to do something every Tuesday. And then we have lunch, and we often play Mexican train in the afternoon. So these are mainly foreigners in that, but I have had some Chinese who join us at times too.
I think about myself and my time here, and I've got a decade in, and I don't know if I'll be here too much longer. I'm happy to stay, but it will depend on where my wife's career takes us. And I just think of myself thinking, wow, 10 years, and I have some friends who 13, 14 years, and I have a couple of friends who are 20-some-odd years, and I'm just like, I can't wait to tell them, you've got to meet Eleanor.
Now, your wife grew up where?
She's from Seattle.
Seattle.
She was born in Montana, and then after, I think she was, by the time she was 6 or 7, she was in Seattle. So her formative years were in Seattle. Mm-hmm. My wife, we met in Boston.
You met both.
Yeah, she had this notion. She graduated university, and she spent a couple of years in Spokane, where her university was. And then she just got this notion in her head she needed to go live somewhere else, and she didn't know where. So she got in the car and started driving across America. She looped down to the Southwest, went through the South, came up, and she hit Boston, and she met me, and...
That was it.
well, I would like to say that was it. That would be the easiest, but
it took a while.
well, she decided when she met me that she wanted to live in Boston. I am a bit of a nerd and a know-it-all, so I would give these tours of the city, and she came on a tour that I gave, and she liked the people that she met, and when she came on my tour and we met, we hung out a few times and went on a couple of dates, and we knew we liked each other, but which she came to Boston just as I was leaving.
Oh.
So I left Boston in 2008, and she arrived 6 weeks before I left. So we met, and we had this kind of...
Then you corresponded.
We did. We stayed in touch. We didn't stay in a relationship or anything because I was living overseas. I wasn't coming back. But then about 4.5 years ago, we both had been in relationships, and we had broken up with our, significant others around the same time. And I was in the U.S. visiting, and she was living in New Zealand, but she saw on social media that I was in America. And she said, hey, are you going to be there? Because I'm coming back, and I'm quitting my job, and I've left my boyfriend, and maybe we could get together and see where we're at. And I said, no, I'm not staying. But if you come to Beijing, we could, give it a shot. And she said, okay.
Right.
So
you got married here?
We did. We got the paperwork, got the little red book, which is great. That's a lovely souvenir. It's something you don't get in America. You should have these little red books. So we got married, and now we're just kind of starting this expat journey together, this migration journey. We don't know where we're going to end up. We don't know how long we'll stay here, what country we'll end up in, but we have a sense we're going to be on the road for a long time.
Yeah.
She's just starting this career, and she's finding it very rewarding teaching the children.
Well, you tell her the whole world is your native land.
Yeah.
You don't have to stay in one corner.
Well, you've had quite the journey yourself, and it's incredibly impressive.
I know it. In a lot of ways, I can remember in the second grade, the teacher showed a film of Chinese planting rice, and I was fascinated with China from that time, I just thought, oh, I would love to see China.
Boy, have you seen it.
And then, so when the children were in high school, we had a very good friend, Dr. Ku, who had been, he got his doctorate in IU, and he had brought his 14-year-old daughter to America, and she was living there. Diana was 14, our daughter. So he came to us and he said, well, now I'm going back to China, to Taiwan, and said, why don't we switch children? I can take Diana and Anna, and they can go to the Taipei American School. And then next year, we can John Dee can go. So we decided to do that. And she left in January with them, and she hadn't been gone a week. I said, John, I cannot do without her for a year. And so just we were making arrangements for her to go to the American school. And when they sent me some things to fill out for her, the secretary said, the superintendent is in America recruiting teachers. So I said, send me an application.
I'm a teacher.
So they sent me an application, and right away they hired me. So Diana was there from January till the summer, and she went to school with Anna. And then I had told John, I said, I can't stand it. We've got to go. So I had already got my contract, and we left we went across country to California, and we left on the Sakura Maru, and the three of us, with John Dennison, John and me, and we were on this Japanese ship and went to Japan. And then we stayed on the ship and went overnight to different places, and we left at Kobe. And then we flew to Taiwan, met Diana, and so they both went to high school there. John Dennis was 9th grade and she was 10th. And I was teaching in the middle school, and I was teaching 6th grade. And later the principal of the middle school told me that I was the only teacher he had, so the others were just babysitting. And they were first year teachers and wives of the army officers. And he said, they're not really interested in teaching the kids. They just want to see the world and go see things, and they would take all their sick days and go hear Madame Chung speak or something. Well, one of them told me, he said, you're crazy. And I said, well, I don't take a sick day unless I'm sick. I said, that's what it's for. And I'm not going to say I'm sick when I'm not. And I'm not going to take a leave. If they don't pay me for them, it's okay. But I just want to.
Well, there is a whole industry now of these teachers who are serious and devoted to teaching now, and they're teaching at all these international schools, and you've really blazed a trail.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah. I want to thank you for letting us into your home and for sharing your story with us. It's been really wonderful to talk to you.
Well, it's been nice to talk with you, and good luck to you and your wife, and I hope you find just the right spot.
Thank you very much.
Well, there you have it. Thank you again to Ellen Olu for making the time and letting me come in an interview. I really learned a lot. It was really eye-opening. You heard her mention her book. It's her memoir. It's called The Red Thread. There's a link to where you can buy it on Amazon in the notes. I highly recommend it. It's really interesting. There's lots of great photos and letters and stuff. And if you like what you hear, please leave a comment. You could send an email to migratorypatterns@migrationmedia.net. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.